we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Show, Western Canada's only radio program focusing on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is CFRO 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, Vancouver, Canada. Today is Friday, August the 18th, 2017. For the next hour, I'm your host, Jen Dobell, and I'm joined in studio by my animal-loving vegan co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
Allison Cole.
Hi there.
And Jillian Walters.
Hi.
On today's show, we have a feature interview with Australian journalist and filmmaker James Hyams, who created a feature-length documentary, a short exposé, which has won 7 awards at film festivals, and a book about the South Korean dog meat trade. But first, we begin with a discussion that often comes up around this issue, which is the speciesist outrage exhibited by non-vegans when the topic of Asians eating dogs or cats arises. And I can speak to this myself. I've only been vegan about 3.5 years, and I remember being outraged that people in other countries ate animals that I considered companion animals. And now, being a vegan and someone who has seen the Earthlings documentary, I look back on that as absolutely speciesist and totally ignorant. I can't even believe that I felt that way without reflecting upon my own choices in life that harmed animals in just as a horrific way. What do you think, everybody?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I think there's definitely an enormous double standard. People in North America, at least as somebody who lives in North America, there's this outrage, right? How could they treat those animals that way in that part of the world? But of course, we treat many other animals who are just as capable of feeling and experiencing life in the same way as dogs. You know, we treat them horrifically here, and when you call each other out about that here, then you get a very different response, generally speaking. You know, people act as though, well, it's our right to do this. This is the way it's always been. Well, you know, they say the same things about dogs in Asia. So
we're conditioned, right, mm-hmm. to love one species and eat the other. From mm-hmm. a very young age, you know, kids are taught, you know, take the best care of your pet or your companion animal, but then here's your bacon for breakfast. So it's a real interesting topic.
And Jillian, speaking of bacon, you went vegan, what, 30 years ago,
yes.
would you say? And it relates to pigs, doesn't it? The mm-hmm. reason that you went vegan. Why don't you tell us that story?
Yeah, I think I've told it before, but for interested listeners, I was probably a teenager, and the farm, well, it was a family across the street that had pigs. And one day I heard this truck rumbling down the road and the screaming of what I found out were the pigs. And the screaming was so horrific. Like, it felt like it pierced my heart, and I just couldn't believe what was happening. And then my mom told me that they were going to go to slaughter, and I was like, oh. And that's when I kind of started to tie in eating hot dogs is eating a pig, eating hamburgers is eating a cow. Even though I kind of knew it on some level, it didn't resonate deeply until that point. And there was more instances like that kind of led to my vegan journey.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you made the connection. I was at the White House about a week ago doing a demonstration about ending speciesism, and I met a woman who said to me, she was just a tourist that was visiting the White House, and she said, I'm already vegan, and I gave her a hug. I said, that's awesome. And then her daughter was there, and her daughter said, we have a pig. And I said, for a pet? And she said, yes. And I said, oh, well, I guess that means you don't eat hot dogs or bacon or anything, because you know how intelligent and loving a pig is, and you know how they have emotions. And she said, oh, no, I still eat hot dogs. And I thought, well, I hope this day comes where you make that connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are many friends of mine who have approached me before and said, you know, it's great that you speak out for animals, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I think about these things. People have compassion for animals, but then when it comes to the moments where they're, you know, walking up to a hot dog stand or sitting around a table of pizza with some friends or whatever, you know, they lose sight of it because of the conditioning, because it's a lifelong thing. And actually, I was having a conversation with a friend yesterday. He was talking about how he used to love fishing, and now he doesn't so much anymore. He feels bad for the fish, and that's one thing I was thinking about. Fishing is one thing right now. Summertime, everyone's fishing, and fishing is something that humans consider to be this leisurely, relaxing, recreational activity. And because our disconnect from fish is so huge, we don't realize this relaxing activity is actually torturing somebody else, mm-hmm. right? So speciesism is so enormous and so widespread and so deeply entrenched in us that we can't even see this enormous suffering that's happening right in front of our eyes. Mm-hmm.
And I remember being told lies that animals don't feel pain mm-hmm. to justify mm-hmm. it. Yeah. Allison, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I wanted to talk about the term carnism, because that's sort of what we're talking about here. It's a term that Dr. Melanie Joy coined years ago. We had her on the show when she first wrote her book, and I always forget the name of it, Why We Love Dogs, Eat pigs and Wear cows. I got it right. I always get them mixed up. And yeah, Jen and I were fortunate enough to be able to see her recently at the Animal Rights Conference. And yeah, we had her on the show in like 2009 when that book first came out. And she spoke about carnism. Carnism is the invisible belief system or ideology that conditions people to eat certain animals. Certain animals, not all. Carnism is essentially the opposite of veganism, as carn means flesh or of the flesh, and ism refers to a belief system. So when people do favor one species over another, when they favor, oh, I would never do that to a dog, like how dare they do that in South Korea and China, but they have no problem doing it to a cow, whereas in India they would never do that to a cow, right? And like how can they do that, but yet they'll eat other animals there. So it all comes down to carnism, which is an invisible belief that people think they don't have, but they do. It's actually a belief system that we're ingrained with, but people don't acknowledge it.
And changing that belief system is very difficult for some people because it's so entrenched, and it's like almost like changing your consciousness, which is, it doesn't happen overnight for some people. It takes a longer amount of time.
Mm-hmm. But, of course, recognizing that, and that's so much of what this show is about, is raising awareness of these issues, making people think about these things, and encouraging people to live by their values. This isn't like pushing some evil agenda. It's saying, here, there's suffering here. You don't believe in that, do you? Like, unnecessary suffering. Why participate in it? So let's step back and look at our actions critically and change. And that's why abandoning animal products is so empowering, not only, of course, to the animals who would no longer be exploited if we weren't doing that to them, but I mean, I can speak for myself as an individual, you know, recognizing these patterns and then saying, I don't have to be a part of this. Like, this is ingrained in me for so long, this has been ingrained in me, but I'm looking at this, I'm saying I don't agree with it, and I'm doing the best I can to live according to those values. So like that's empowering. That's a good thing for everybody.
Go ahead.
Oh, and most people would never harm, like they were born with empathy. Most people would never hurt another animal on purpose. Mm-hmm. So it's just realizing that the other animals
are getting
hurt.
I always say we're born as vegans. We get the empathy that it totally like just like seeped out of us, right? Mm-hmm. And we've done interviews on that before too. I did an interview, like I think last year, there was a book about children and in animal emotions, children's emotions versus animal emotions, and how animals relate, or how children, human children, relate to animals, and how they grow loving animals with empathy and kindness. And unfortunately, that gets grown out of us. We grow out of it. Isn't that a sad thing to grow out of? Empathy and mm-hmm. compassion.
Well, interestingly enough, our show today does feature interview with somebody who made a documentary. And speaking of documentaries, Okja is the latest hit on Netflix right now. And that is something that children could watch probably
really?
At a certain age, I would say. And Sinead, what did you think about Okja? You watched it, right?
Yeah. It. I thought it was great. You know, obviously there aren't It wasn't perfect from an animal rights perspective, but it's getting a lot of people talking. And again, it's getting a lot of people coming up to me saying, you know, you're a person who talks about animal rights. I watched this movie and it was so great. And I think it's so great what you're doing. And then a lot of them will still go and eat the hot dogs and everything and say, like, oh, there's this great wing place, What's Up Hot Dog. They do vegan wing nights on Mondays, half-price vegan wings made of cauliflower. They're so good. And they're going, yeah, come for vegan wing night, and maybe I'll even get the cauliflower wings as well. And I'm going, well, like, maybe. You just watched Okja. Why would you choose the torture wings versus the cauliflower wings when they're both,
I know. Someone told me yesterday they watched Okja, and I thought they were going to follow up with, and I want to go vegan, but instead they said, and now I want to find a local humane farm. And I had to bite my tongue. I was in a professional situation, but I wanted to say, there's no such thing. They all go to the same slaughterhouse, and how is it humane to take the life of someone who doesn't get a choice?
Yeah, basically, it's like, if you don't believe in animals as objects, if you believe in them as individuals deserving of respect for their sentience and their lives, then don't pay for animals like objects. Don't fund industries that treat them as such.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food. Sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food. Hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
And now for the news. Days after the Crown withdrew the animal cruelty charges laid by the Ontario SPCA, Gia, another beluga whale, has died at Marineland. And I mentioned a couple weeks ago, the great-grandmother of the three-month-old orca that recently died at SeaWorld, Kasatka, she died this week as well, spent her life in captivity. I think she was 48, I believe, when she died.
Wow. I feel like we're always hearing stories of animals dying in aquariums and zoos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's getting really
there are a lot of
heavy.
Them.
I have to admit, I don't even click on the headlines anymore. I'm just so tired of it.
I saw a picture of the orca whale yesterday, and she had a really bad skin disease. And I wasn't able to read it, but do they know what she died of?
I think it was a lung.
Okay.
Lung infection. I'm not sure, but she had
been suffering
for a long time.
Her skin condition was really bad, though, too.
Yeah,
it looked really poor, and that's really indicative of living in a small little aquarium where they're just swimming around and around in circles.
Well, imagine living in a concrete box for 48 years. That is barely even conceivable.
And sometimes in chlorinated water, you wonder why they have skin conditions. What were you going to say?
Oh, and then you've got the Vancouver Aquarium, who is suing the Vancouver Parks Board in an attempt to overturn the bylaw, which in May voted to ban the aquarium from confining whales and dolphins and porpoises in its facility in Stanley Park. And I was sat through those park board hearings for 3 nights, and I heard John Nightingale state that he would accept the Parks Board ban decision. So it's on record, but it doesn't surprise me that he's suing. But my jaw did drop when I heard what his legal team claims, what they're claiming. They're saying that the practice of confining cetaceans in captivity is a form of expression protected under Section 2B of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And I thought, oh my God, like, what lengths some people will go to in order to keep exploiting animals. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, as if, having a dog and then keeping your dog on display in a glass box on your front lawn for 10 years,
charging money.
Yeah, that's a form of expression, under that argument. You could do that.
And the organization Animal Justice is fighting against that because of its ridiculousness, right?
Yeah, yeah. They're saying that the aquarium's freedom of expression claim is a troubling lawsuit, and it could permanently undermine animal protection laws right across Canada. And that's from Camille Lebchuk, lawyer of Animal Justice.
Mm-hmm.
Another Animal Justice also uncovered a video from the Papanek Zoo near Ottawa that shows abusive animals, and that's another issue. Ontario has no laws to protect these animals. They have the weakest laws in the country, and when it comes to zoos and owning exotic animals, anybody can do it. There's no regulation whatsoever. And that kind of ties in with what's happening right now at UBC. They're having an event called Furry Friend Day, and they've hired the Cinema Zoo, which was investigated for cruelty by the SPCA back in 2010. And yeah, I spoke with the organizer and asked them if they would consider canceling the event, and reminded them that the UBC's motto is UBC, bold thinking is given a place to develop into ideas that can change the world. We encourage students, staff, and faculty to challenge convention, lead discovery, and explore new ways of learning. I mean, wouldn't this be
evolve?
A great opportunity?
Like, they want people to evolve.
Yeah. And, you know, a petting zoo is so backward. Old school, like it's
yes,
you know.
But yet they're going along with it, and it's on right now. And my friend Patrick is there leafleting, doing vegan outreach.
Yay!
He came to my house this morning to grab 150 leaf booklets. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, that's the Cinema Zoo rent out animals. Mm-hmm. That's animals as objects.
Yeah,
you know, buying and selling, trading,
and they get no choice in the matter.
Mm-hmm. And just ending off with the grizzly bear trophy hunting. It's, you know, the NDP announced that it was ending. Well, it's not the most exciting news as we think it is.
Yeah, not exactly the way that the victory that they're painting it as. As Green Party leader Andrew Weaver said, it's all political spin. There's no ban. Let's be very clear. There's no ban on grizzly hunting in BC. What there is some loose language, promises that it will be made illegal to possess hide or head or hair of grizzlies. Under the new rules, hunting for grizzlies will be completely banned in the Great Bear Rainforest, and hunters elsewhere will only be allowed to keep bear meat, not trophy parts. But Weaver says under the NDP's proposed rules, foreign trophy hunters could still come to BC, shoot a grizzly, and pose for a trophy photo, regardless of whether they take the head or hide. It's not perfect right now, but we still have to speak out on this issue.
Yes, exactly. Thanks for mentioning that, Sinead.
Everybody, join us.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
Australian investigative journalist James Hyams spent 2 years creating his 90-minute documentary, The Dog Meat Professionals, plus a dog meat expose and a book on the same topic. 2.5 million dogs and thousands of cats are slaughtered each year in South Korea, forced to endure deprivation and unimaginable torture from the moment they are born until the day they are slaughtered. Dogs are imprisoned in cramped, filthy, raised cages all their lives with no protection from extreme weather. They get no water, exercise, companionship, or medical care, and they never feel the ground beneath their feet. Their eardrums are often burst to prevent them from barking. In broad daylight, often in front of other live dogs, they are electrocuted, hanged, beaten, have their throats slashed, or are boiled and burned to death. This is a profit-driven, tax-free, unregulated industry that aggressively promotes the myth that eating a dog enhances male virility and stamina. Koreans claim that the more a dog suffers, the better its meat is. So many dogs are sadistically made to experience extreme fear and suffering prior to death. Cats are frequently boiled alive to make health tonics too. The demand is so high that South Korea, 20% of the dogs eaten there are now imported from China. South Korea is the only country known to have large intensive farming systems to supply the demand for dog meat. Filmmaker James Hyams joins us for a discussion about the social and health costs associated with this industry, as well as the legal issues. Eating dog meat is not legal in South Korea, but the government and general public fail to enact this law.
We're speaking with James Hyams now. James, can you please tell us about your two films and your book?
Yeah, I can. So over the past few years, I traveled back and forth to South Korea. I partnered up with a man named Tae-hoon Lee. He's an investigative journalist in South Korea and has been for many decades. And we basically started looking into the dog meat industry in South Korea. We also teamed up with AJ Garcia from CARE. And So Tae-hoon and I, we basically traveled across significant portions of South Korea trying to understand the dog meat industry in its, you know, in full. And we went to slaughterhouses, we went to dog farms, we interviewed the Dog Meat Association, we interviewed vets. I spent a lot of time embedded with activists, and Tae-hoon went to a lot of Dog Meat Association events and meetings and those sorts of things. As a Korean, it was easier for him to fit in. As a white guy, for me, obviously, I'd stand out. And we basically, over around about an 18-month period, ingrained ourselves in the dog meat industry. So we basically saw it from all perspectives, all sides of the story, including local residents living near the farms. And we monitored the expansion and extraction of the dog meat industry. So basically we saw certain farms, the bigger farms getting bigger, the smaller farms starting to close down, or at least making efforts to transition into other industries so that they can at least make some better money. And over a two-year period, we put together a documentary. So we put together a feature-length documentary titled The Dog Meat Professionals, South Korea. And from the footage that we got from activists and also some of the footage we shot ourselves using smartphones and other devices, we put it into a short film called Korean Dog Meat Exposé. Now, the short film Korean Dog Meat Exposé has been doing the rounds on the film festivals, and so far it's won 7 awards in different film festivals, and it's doing quite well. But it is graphic, it is very violent, and it is a very powerful short documentary. It's so powerful that some people just won't screen it at their film festivals. There was one film festival that didn't screen it but awarded us, even though they didn't screen it, because So that was a bit bizarre in itself. Another film festival, the SF3, which I'm flying to next week in Sydney, Australia. The dog meat documentary, Korean Dog Meat Exposé, won't be screened there despite being shortlisted in the top 10. And instead, they've elected to put in another one of my documentaries, Interview with a Cocaine Merchant in Australia, here in Brisbane. And consequently, that's being screened instead of the Korean Dog Meat Exposé documentary, which is quite disappointing for me because obviously I spent 2 years on this project, and I would prefer to get as much exposure for the dog meat trade in South Korea as possible. And the short documentary or the feature-length documentary has not been shown in Australia yet. It seems like broadcasters, distributors, and film festivals are all frightened of this topic. I actually got an email back from a lady named Kay Warren, who works for SBS in Australia, and she basically said this topic is a really hard topic to broadcast and to get people to be wanting to watch. And reading behind the lines there of what she's written, you know, I've encountered a lot of activists who are deeply hurt by seeing any form of physical harm to animals, yet they're more than willing to put money behind a documentary like this being screened or at least being produced. But at the end of the day, just putting money behind it and not willing to watch it, that kind of puts off broadcasters. Broadcasters want to be able to know that they're going to be able to sell advertising around these documentaries, and they're going to get a lot of people watching them, a lot of people talking about the documentary, and also they want to be able to attract new people watching this documentary either on their website or on their television station. So that's basically it for the Dog Meat Professionals and Korean Dog Meat Exposé in Australia at the moment. The awards that it's won in India, America, and I think one in Europe as well.
So what got you interested in pursuing this topic, James?
Well, I was writing for the Korea Observer as a journalist. I was a deputy editor there maybe 6 months before we started talking about doing documentaries. And one of the documentary topics that I wanted to look at was the illegal and unlawful whale trade between Japan and South Korea. And consequently, that got me interested also in pursuing the dog meat trade. So I put together a number of pitches for documentary ideas, and we narrowed it down to those two that I just mentioned, the dog meat trade and also the unlawful whale trade across the international lines from Japan to South Korea. And at the end of it, Tae-hoon Lee, the publisher of the Korea Observer, said that we should be focusing on the dog meat trade as opposed to the whale meat trade, and that's the one that we should be doing first. So I started looking into it. I wrote a few articles, and it generated substantial interest. I think the first article I wrote about the dog meat trade in South Korea got shared something like 2,000 times in the first couple of days, and there were hundreds of people commenting and reacting, and unfortunately a lot of those comments were racist and misinformed, and that to me kind of drove me to learn more about the dog meat trade and to really understand it from deep inside. And that's what we tried to do with the Dog Meat Professionals documentary, and I think we've done that quite well. So yeah, that was the motivation to get in and really understand the trade properly and to expose the realities of the dog meat trade in South Korea in a way which most people can consume it, watch it, and hopefully take up the cause as well.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned racist comments in regards to your film. Animal Voices is a vegan radio show, and all of our volunteers are vegan animal rights activists. And we're always trying to bring awareness to the topic of speciesism. Before I became vegan, I also criticized Asian cultures for killing and eating the animals that I considered beloved pets. And now that I look back on that viewpoint of mine, I'm kind of surprised and embarrassed that I said things that could be perceived as definitely racism and singling out a certain population of people based on the value that I placed on certain animals over others. And it's funny when you look at the way that we treat our farm animals, really there's not much difference. And so today our topic with you is really about speciesism in many ways, and I just want to know what you think about that.
There is a different level of extremeness in the dog meat trade that we don't seem to have anywhere else in the world that I've seen or come across. And I'm not saying that factory farming is not an issue. It certainly is. And I've covered this in the book that I've released on Amazon. It's called The Dog Meat Professionals as well, Investigating the South Korean Dog Meat Trade. And basically, I make a comparison to pigs. And yeah, basically what we are seeing is that dogs are confined in small spaces, they're raised in those small spaces, their feet never really touch the ground until it's time for slaughter, and they're killed at about 15 months of age. So for all intensive purposes, the dog meat trade overlaps quite strongly with the pig trade. And there was a movie released in South Korea and around the world recently on Netflix, called Okja, O-K-J-A, which was about a super pig. And basically the concept behind the super pig, most people drew a parallel to, obviously, the pig meat industry, but also in South Korea you can draw a parallel directly to the dog meat industry. And that movie kind of indirectly highlights the differences and the similarities between the dog meat trade and the pig meat trade. And I can tell you now, there's not many differences. They're basically very similar. Except with the one exception, the dog meat trade isn't entirely lawful. And I also mentioned this in my book. The dog meat trade, while dog is listed as livestock under the law in South Korea, there is other legislation that governs the slaughter of animals and providing sanitation for food and those sorts of things. So in that separate act, they do not include dogs as animals for slaughter as food. So consequently, in one act, dog is food. In another act, dog is not included as food. And consequently, there's no way the government can govern the slaughter of dogs, whereas in South Korea at least they do govern the slaughter of pigs and cows and chickens, you know. And while these measures for governing the slaughter of so-called traditional livestock animals, while these while the legislation is completely incomplete and it is inhumane to kill any animal for food, at the end of the day, the dog meat industry is entirely unregulated, which really allows for rogue operators to do what they want. And it's unfortunate that in the process, a lot of dogs get killed in the most horrific ways possible. You know, we have footage of dogs being hung by the neck, electrocuted to death, which is the most common form of killing method, beaten on the head with metal bars and, you know, that sort of thing. And it's really graphic, really horrible and really disgusting. And if there were cows killed in such a way or pigs killed in such a way, the South Korean population would be up in arms. But because it's dogs, it kind of falls outside of the law governing the slaughter of livestock. And the only subsection of the Animal Welfare Act that governs the slaughter of dogs is Article 7 and 8 of the Animal Welfare Act Clause 1, which basically stipulates that dogs are not to be hung by their neck or killed in a cruel manner. But how do we define a cruel manner? We've seen cases go before the court in South Korea where dogs have been hit on the head in front of other dogs with a hammer and they haven't been prosecuted. Just in the next couple of weeks, there's also another case that's before the courts. It's been challenged, so it's gone to the High Court of Korea. And in that court, they're going to be looking again at a not guilty verdict. A farmer allegedly electrocuted 30 dogs to death, and the South Korean activists at the moment have challenged this, saying that, hang on, this guy killed dogs in front of other dogs and therefore is in violation of the Animal Protection Act and should be prosecuted. So in the next few weeks, if that matter is sorted in the High Court in the next few weeks, it'll set a precedent either way, determining whether or not it is lawful to kill dogs en masse in front of other dogs or unlawful. And we know it's unlawful because it says so in the Act, but at the same time, what the law says and what is actually punished by the courts can sometimes be a very different thing, especially in South Korea.
Well, we actually see the same lack of compliance and law enforcement in Canada. And so on another topic, I'm curious, can you tell us what the vegan or vegetarian movement is looking like in South Korea? I'm actually hopeful that this may be a way that we can turn around this cruelty toward dogs.
So what we need to remember is that there is a large, or it's a minority, but it's a large percentage of the population still that is Buddhist. And for the most part, the Buddhists who are practicing in temples do not eat meat. And some Buddhists in South Korea follow the same practice. And these are regular people who don't obviously wear the monk outfits and they go to a 9-to-5 job every day. Some of those people are also vegans. And there are a certain number of restaurants in South Korea that cater to these people. Now, I don't know in Korean whether they would identify themselves as vegan, but they just don't eat meat. But in saying that, there is a huge percentage of the South Korean population that eat meat. One of the national pastimes in South Korea is to invite your friends out for Korean barbecue, where they all sit around a table and they, you know, cook their own meat in a restaurant, and the restaurant brings out certain cuts of meat for them, and they share beer and soju, which is like a rice wine that's quite strong, maybe 11 to 17% alcohol, I think. And this is a national pastime where, you know, families and groups of friends get together and they consume meat on a barbecue and drink alcohol. And, you know, there's no real vegetables involved in that meal. I mean, you might get the occasional side dish of kimchi. Well, actually, every place serves kimchi as a side dish. But the main ingredient for that consumption is just meat by itself with the sauce. And that means that a lot of meat is consumed. So to try and change that culture in South Korea is huge. It's massive. And it's not going to happen. You know, outside pressure is not going to stop South Koreans from eating meat. And dog, in that sense, is the fourth most consumed meat in South Korea. And a lot of South Koreans just see dog as another livestock animal, which I think is what a lot of vegans see dog as well, when they consider the mentality of a pig or a cow or a chicken, you know, all sentient beings deserve life, and they don't deserve to be killed prematurely for us to survive, because we don't obviously don't need to survive on meat. We know that now. We know we don't need meat in our diets to continue to live. Only a very, very small percentage of the population can say with any certainty that, yes, I need a certain type of protein or a certain type of vitamin that I can only get from meat. But for an overwhelming majority of the population, they don't need meat. And it's the same in South Korea. They simply do not need to eat meat, but they choose to because, once again, it's a national pastime. It tastes good, the same as anywhere else in the world. You know, people are blind to the animal suffering, and the marketers and the Dog Meat Association and other associations related to livestock animals, they continue to perpetuate the problem by spreading mistruths. You know, like meat is required for a healthy diet, or dog meat will improve male stamina and help the man to be able to have sex with the wife and partner or whatnot. These sorts of things are the mistruths that are spread by the Dog Meat Association, and they are honestly believed by men and women in South Korea. The older population believe that dog meat is an aphrodisiac, and it does give men, you know, the ability to perform better in bed, and it does give men the ability to be stronger and, you know, climb flights of stairs and do manly tasks more efficiently and effectively. And, you know, obviously then dog meat and other meat as well is tied in with masculinity. And you don't want to challenge a South Korean man's masculinity because they just don't like that. They believe that, you know, this meat is doing them good. And just like any other man who in the West might have a beer and go away with mates and pretend to be, you know, super masculine, South Korean men do that with dog meat and beer and other meat as well.
Well, as I watched your film, I wondered if this tradition may die off with the aging population, or are those traditions and unscientific beliefs adopted by the younger generations as well? What are your thoughts on this? Were you able to speak with some of the younger people and ask them if this is something that they are having a growing disgust against and perhaps are changing their traditions as values too? Or are you finding that everyone of all age groups is complicit in this and you see that it will continue?
16 to do the same survey basically again, so that we could do a T1 and T2 analysis. So, you know, 5 years apart, so that we can understand if there was a shift in mentality about the dog meat trade. And what we found, that a vast majority of the Korean population currently opposes dog meat. Only 26.3% of the population are pro-dog meat, whereas 57.5% are against it as of 2016, compared to 30.8% who were pro and 41.7% who were against it in 2011. So this shows a 4.5% decline in those who are pro dog meat and a 15.8% increase in those who are against the dog meat industry. And this is just over a 5-year period. So we are seeing a rapid change in South Koreans' mentality about the dog meat trade. And that is because of a number of things. I mean, of course, animal welfare activists have been pushing against dog meat for a long time, and slowly, you know, these messages are starting to get into the minds of South Koreans. But also, there was a show on TV a couple of years ago now where it was revealed that pet dogs were raised in inhumane conditions as well, and they were being slaughtered and killed in horrific ways after, you know, at the end of their lifespan, when they were no longer good for breeding. And these sorts of things impacted on the minds of Koreans. It actually made a lot of the population angry. And then that opened the door for Korean activists to start talking about the dog meat industry. And now that we have the new president in, President Moon, who has just adopted Tori from CARE. Tori's a rescue dog who could not get adopted in South Korea because of his dark colorings. And, you know, he's not the most beautiful dog that you're going to see in South Korea, but he is a lovely dog, and the president decided to adopt him from care. So his Tori, rescue dog, is now the first dog in South Korea, in the Blue House, which is the equivalent of the White House in America. So these are all positive things. This all represents a shift away from the dog meat trade. However, we are seeing, and this is not normally reported on, we are seeing a shift from the Dog Meat Association back toward promoting dog meat again. So whatever the activists are doing to speak out against the dog meat trade, we have an equal push for dog meat from the Dog Meat Association in South Korea. Now, the Dog Meat Association is huge. It is massive. At every single protest, it has several hundred, if not thousands, of members attending, chanting, screaming their messages, you know, through megaphones, and they want dog meat to be legalized. They are saying the government is neglecting them and that the agricultural department in South Korea should be disbanded, that the ministers should be dismissed because they're not doing their job properly. That dog is a meat that's widely consumed in South Korea, and we all know that, but they're not ensuring that it's a sanitary product that people are consuming. And they're right. What they're saying isn't wrong, but at the end of the day, South Korea is never going to legalize dog meat. It does not want the trade repercussions. It does not want the international backlash. Status quo means that the farmers will continue to raise dogs. They will continue to make money. They will continue to meet as a collective and get concessions and grants from the government and councils, which they do anyhow, without formally legalizing dog meat. So for all intents and purposes, dog meat is legal anyhow, because it's not illegal, and the prosecutions against people who kill dogs in inhumane ways aren't really done. So consequently, dogs are killed in inhumane ways. That dog meat can be sanitary from certain farms and unsanitary from other farms, and the government seems to be okay with that because they're not moving on it. So to answer your question, yes, there is a shift away from dog meat popularity in South Korea, but at the same time, there's an equal push back from the Dog Meat Association to encourage more dog farming and increased demand in South Korea. Now, one interesting thing that I need to mention is that the Dog Meat Association in South Korea is price fixing. So what that means is that they hold meetings across the country with dog farmers to determine what the price of dog meat should be and how many tons of dog meat they should be producing. And what happened during some of the meetings in which we had people undercover in, the Dog Meat Association suggested that farmers needed to reduce the amount of dogs that they had by 10% in order to restrict the amount of supply so that that a marginal shift in demand won't affect the price of dog meat. So they're basically trying to fix prices to the extent where the farmers maintain their own profits, that the Dog Meat Association maintains its own income at the same level that it's been at, and that it appears like the dog meat industry isn't shrinking. But in essence, it is shrinking, but it's only a marginal decrease in the amount of sales of dog meat.
Running out
of time here, so is there anything that people can do who are living in North America, listeners to our show? Okay. Well, the dog meat industry has been basically continuing with very minimum interruption for many decades now in South Korea. And obviously, you know, if you speak to someone like Dr. Dogmeat, he'll say it had been going on for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I'm not disputing that, but it's really become a mainstream sort of meat available nearly everywhere in South Korea in the last 30 or 40 years. And consequently, it could take that amount of time to start to reduce demand to the level where the industry becomes a niche market rather than a mainstream sort of market. What can the North Americans do to impact on the dog meat industry in South Korea directly? Well, to be frank, there's not a lot one can do as a North American. Movies such as Okja are effective, but they are minimally effective. The documentary that I've produced, it could have some minimal effect in South Korea if screened in South Korea itself. But the best thing that could be done to minimize the meat consumption, or dog meat especially consumption in South Korea, is to highlight the health ramifications of eating dog meat. One thing that is often overlooked is that there is a major risk that there will be a disease, an epidemic, where a disease will spread from dogs into humans, and it could be very fatal. And the reason why this is overlooked is because it's just something that doesn't even enter people's minds. We've seen foot and mouth disease. We've seen mad cow disease. We've seen bird flu. We know that there are diseases that are passed from either consuming or raising animals in unhygienic, unsafe environments where, you know, the disease then spreads to people. But at the end of the day, we don't know what happens if someone eats a dog, for example, that has parvovirus, or a dog that has coronavirus, or heartworm, for example. We really don't know the impact that has on humans' health. And it's only a matter of time before those impacts spread among the Korean population. And if that happens, overnight we will see a shift against the dog meat trade. And basically, that sort of thing would shut the dog meat trade down very quickly. Unfortunately, that would mean the loss of human life, and that's not good either. But what can a North Korean do to help end the dog meat trade? Inform themselves, read my book, get an understanding as to what the dog meat trade is really about. When this documentary is eventually available online, probably the middle of 2018, watch the documentary in full and get an adequate understanding of what the activists in South Korea are doing, and then support those honest, ethical activists to go about their work and provide them with the resources that they need, because the animal welfare resources in South Korea are very limited, and they're doing the best they can with very little resources. So that's basically what they can contribute.
Well, I agree with your thinking that working the health angle may be the only way to create change in behavior around consumption of dog meat. Those who exhibit apathy around the mistreatment of animals tend to require different approaches, such as education around health or environment. And I think when people see your film, they'll be disgusted by what passes as food for these dogs. I'm surprised there aren't already health issues in regards to this alone. When people see the film, they'll see what I mean, and we look forward to sharing that when it does come out in 2019.
Well, a lot of the dogs get sick and die prematurely. And if those dogs are then fed back to dogs, it will create some sort of bacteria that dogs haven't encountered before, and there could be an epidemic. Now, most dog farmers are smart enough to know that you don't feed dead dogs that have died from disease to other dogs. But unfortunately, some dog farmers may do that anyhow. And you just need one person who doesn't understand how zoonotic diseases work, and then that's going to have a very unfortunate epidemic that spreads through the Korean population, and a lot of the population will get sick.
Well, thank you so much, James. Can you let our listeners know where they can find more information about this online, or finding your book?
Okay, so if you want to follow the film and what's going on with the dog meat trade in South Korea, there are a few places, but the film Facebook page is probably a good place to start. If you search the Dog Meat Professionals South Korea in Facebook, you'll come up with the page that we've dedicated to that documentary. Another site that's good to get information off is KoreanDogs.org, and they have up-to-date information all the time. Also, if you search for my book on Amazon, The Dog Meat Professionals, that's a great resource as well for you to read and circulate with your friends.
That was Australian filmmaker James Hyams discussing his documentary entitled The Dog Meat Professionals about the South Korean dog meat industry. You can find more information on our website at animalvoices.org. And Sinead has some upcoming animal rights events to announce.
Yeah, actually, this event that's happening tomorrow isn't specifically animal rights related, but you know what it is, because human rights are very much animal rights. And tomorrow at City Hall, there's a rally planned to counter the racist rally. There's a racist rally planned at Vancouver City Hall organized by the Worldwide Coalition Against Islam. And so there's this anti-racism rally planned to counter that. And that's at 12:45 p.m. until 4 p.m. at City Hall. And yeah, this is just to oppose racism in Metro Vancouver. And as animal advocates, we should be speaking out for human rights as well. So definitely hope to see some of you out there at City Hall tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll see a lot of social activists out there. They tend to cover all bases when it comes to activism, most people.
I was looking at the numbers. It was looking like thousands.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And maybe 30 of the original.
Going?
Yeah, I'm going to try and go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I'm going to go. And this is hosted by the ad hoc group Stand Up to Racism Metro Vancouver. And that's made up of teachers, students, and activists who want to stand up against Islamophobia and racism in our community. And that's connected to that interview that we just listened to, because, yeah, as we've learned, a lot of animal rights issues can result in some racist attitudes. So definitely important to recognize these issues.
Good point. From 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock, right around that same area, Broadway and Cambie, there's going to be an Earthlings experience hosted by TV Outreach for Animals. And I went to the last one and it was amazing. I think it's like the best demonstration, animal rights demonstration, to get conversations going.
So why don't you describe that for the listeners that don't know what that is?
Oh, right. So there's people, activists holding either laptops or TVs, and they're showing different parts of Earthlings, the movie, and other people are leafleting, and it just really draws a crowd. People come and watch and see the truth. They see what's happening to animals
behind closed doors for our food and clothing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did that one at Kitsilano Beach. You were there,
right,
Jillian, and we had Australian activist James Aspey from just on a world tour, and he does these kinds of things on a regular basis around the world and then uploads his videos of having conversations with people to YouTube. And they're basically veganizing conversations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't ever turn somebody vegan in one conversation typically, but it's interesting to watch and see what kinds of excuses people are coming up with. And they really can be excusitarians, can't they?
A lot of patience is required.
At that event, what were you doing? Were you holding a TV or were you leafleting?
I was doing leafleting and taking pictures.
Okay.
Yeah. Next Friday, August 25th at 7, Professor John Gluck, former primate scientist, will be giving a talk on his recent memoir, Voracious Science and Vulnerable Animals, A Primate Scientist's Ethical Journey. I'm really interested in this one because he's a person who harmed animals in the past and now has changed his belief system and is working against the system. So I'm always interested in those type of
Transformations.
Those stories.
Me too.
Yeah.
I always think it's not possible, but I could tell you so many stories of people that I've met who used to harm animals and never even cared about their emotions, and then they made this turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go to that one too.
Yeah, and the next day after that, Saturday 26th at 12:30 downtown at the Vancouver Art Gallery, there's going to be a PETA demonstration. It's the World Day to end speciesism. I said it.
We practiced before the show. Everybody, let's say it. 1, 2, 3.
Speciesism.
It's a tongue twister.
It sure is. So that's going to be pretty cool. It's going to be cool. It's going to be like an art demo. On September 4th, What Gives? A Day of Giving, Part 2. A local
philanthropist.
Chef. whose food is awesome, is giving away, this time I think it's 300 meals to the people of the Downtown East Side.
Wow.
Last time it was 150, and I volunteered with him and we had to turn people away. So we're doing 300 this time, and I took my son, who's 13, and he wants to go back. He was really, he loved it.
He did such a good job.
Yeah.
He was so friendly, and there was another child there as well, and they did such a great job.
Yeah.
So what can we do to support that event?
There is a list, I think, on the website, if you look it up, of things that they still need.
We'll post that to our Facebook page. Mm-hmm.
So we're looking for all kinds of hygienic toiletries, little sample sizes, and we'll post that event on our Facebook page. That's the only place where it's really, really posted online.
Animal Voices Vancouver.
Yeah.
So if you have any animal-friendly events that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
And you've been listening to the Animal Voices radio show. We here at Animal Voices want to hear from you online. Find our website at animalvoices.org, on Facebook, Animal Voices Vancouver, Twitter, Animal Voices YVR, or email us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Tune in next Friday at noon for our show on National Dog Day and a discussion about dog rescue. Stay tuned next for Radio EcoShock, and remember to be kind to the animals. We leave you with a song by Moby, who is also a vegan animal rights activist, and this is called One of These Mornings. I dedicate this to all the animals who are oppressed by humans.